But when I talked about the end of jobs, I was talking about the end of the 9 to 5, one office, one manager job. That job is going. And technology, like all the things you just highlighted, are one of many factors that help break that bone of no, we need everybody in this office from 9 to 5. They all have to be in within one reporting structure, and we need to understand everybody is. That job is dying. Technology has accelerated, COVID has certainly accelerated, and the remote workforce and the gig workforce are all a very big component of the new world of work.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand Live Show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
Welcome to another episode of the Your Living Brand Live Show. Welcome back, my wonderful audience. You guys are amazing. Every week you tune in, you listen, you comment on LinkedIn, you tell me what you like, you tell me what you don't like, you tell me who you want to hear about. So thank you for your amazing comments. This week, and it's been an interesting week. We've been talking a lot about the gig economy. We've been talking a lot about, where is the future of work? Where are things going? And a lot of businesses, large and small, are scratching their head going, okay, post-COVID, where we are. And my thought process is this goes way beyond COVID. The future of work happened long before COVID started. COVID might have been an accelerator, but I think that there's some real good conversations about where the world is going and how we have to adapt in order to be relevant. So this week, I'm bringing Jeff Wall to the table. Now, Jeff is the author of a book, and I'm going to see if I can get this right, The End of Jobs and the Rise of On-Demand Workers and Agile Corporations. So Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Hey, I'm just a quick shout out to Mark Hirschberg, who I had on the show. Mark said, Ben, you have to have Jeff on the show. He was adamant about it. He was absolutely adamant. He says, you got to hear Jeff's story. You got to hear, the things that he talks about. And I've been to your website and I've watched your videos, and he is absolutely correct. So I am so looking forward to this conversation.
He has been more effective than my PR people, and I appreciate that they may well hear this. So they should know that my friend Mark, who is amazing, has been just a wonderful advocate.
We all need people like that. We all need people who can just sit there and go, you know what? This guy is amazing. You need to talk to him. And we all have those people in our lives, or hopefully we have those people in our lives. And those people should be treated like gold because that's what they're worth.
Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit of a history of Jeff. I mean, you are a serial entrepreneur. You've been in this game a long time. Give us a little history about where you came from and what brought you to the table.
Well, I grew up in upper middle class America, a little town called Port Washington, a suburb of New York City. And honestly, Ben, it's like a Norman Rockwell painting. I mean, it's suburbia USA. It is just I was unbelievably fortunate to grow up there with my family. I started my career not in an entrepreneurial way. It's not like when I was a kid, I had lemonade stands and a business shoveling sidewalks and things like that. I didn't. I started in a very traditional route, which was investment banking. I was an M&A banker at JP Morgan, and I left there to work at a venture capital firm backing entrepreneurs. And it was there that I got this taste for, wow, there's a group of people out there that want to start an entirely new way of doing X. And if they succeed, they're going to make a ton of money. And if they fail, they're going to dust themselves off and keep going, and they're going to try something else. And so I left that venture firm and I started my first company, and it failed miserably, left me broke. I got the call from my mom, do you need to move back home? Now, look, that's a wonderful call to be able to get, to be able to have that support system. But just because it's a beautiful thing doesn't make it any less horrifying to actually get that phone call. It didn't come to that. But I won't pretend that I was so quick to pick myself up and dust myself off. It took some time to lick my wounds and to deal with that failure, but I did, and started another company. And that company eventually got sold to Salesforce. And so that was a good outcome. And the most recent company was this company, WorkMarket, where we were helping companies all over the world to organize, manage, and pay their freelance workforce, their on-demand workers. And so our software was this enterprise software platform that helped efficiently and compliantly engage this very important and growing segment of the labor force. And look, we raised about $100 million from SoftBank, Union Square Ventures, and others, and we sold the company in 2018 to ADP, which is just this amazing, amazing company. People think of them as this payroll company, and they are the world's largest payroll company, but they're also the world's largest HR software company. And they wanted to bolt WorkMarket on to all of their full-time software programs. And it has been amazing. And it gave me the space to finally finish this book that I've been working on for about 5 years before the acquisition.
You know, and that is an amazing journey in the fact that it's the lessons that you learned along the way. So my question to you is, what were the lessons that you learned in your previous, you know, entrepreneurial experiences that led you to WorkMarket, that led you to sit there, go do the aha moment that the gig economy needs help? And I think that that's the crux is because it does. It absolutely does. A lot of it is ad hoc. A lot of it is happens in the shadows. A lot of it happens by accident. And the question is, how did you have that aha moment that sat there and said, wait a second here, this is a part of the workforce that A, needs to be organized and needs to be helped to be able to make it legitimate in the world today?
Well, I'll tell you this, I'm not an aha guy. I'm not a guy that's just like, wait a minute, oh my God, I got it. That's just not Jeff Wald. Jeff Wald is all right, I have some data here. I'm going to analyze it. I'm going to go talk to a bunch of people smarter than me. I'm going to let them challenge it. I'm going to get more data and I'm going to put together a plan. And if I think that that thing has a high probability of working, I'm going to go execute that plan. So there was no one moment. That said, I started working on the concept that is WorkMarket years and years before. And I'll tell you this, every time I make an angel investment or I talk to startup founders, I'll always start with this question. What is the problem you're looking to solve? Whose problem is it? And how big of a problem is it for them? And then how big of a problem is it for the economy? Because as an investor, I want to back people that are solving big problems. Because the bigger the problem you're trying to solve, the more likely you are to be able to make a living or build a company solving it. If you're solving a very small problem, then, I mean, good for you and good for the people that it's their problem, but you can't really build a company that investors, you have a low probability, I should say, building a company investors are going to make some money on. And so it's something I always thought about. And as I was thinking about WorkMarket, I remember reading a study by McKinsey, not the dumbest people out there, about the on-demand economy in corporations around the world and how corporations, and the study was, I think, 2006, 2007. And it talked about how there was about $1 trillion in on-demand labor spend the world over, but companies lack the systems and processes to manage it efficiently and compliantly. And if companies had the right tools, that $1 trillion could become $4 trillion.
That's enormous.
I remember thinking, well, that's a big problem to solve.
Exactly.
Like, let's get companies these tools. What do those tools look like? But let's look at the dates here. That was 2006, maybe 2007. I didn't start WorkMarket until 2010. So there were a lot of conversations. There was a lot of debate and discussion. There was a lot of whiteboarding and putting together presentations and then letting people challenge that notion of what was it going to take to solve it, to drive that kind of growth. And, you know, I don't think we hit it perfectly, but we did well enough. And ADP now is a great home for WorkMarket, and they're doing a wonderful job with that technology and with that team.
So, I mean, you said this is a 2006 ideation of maybe there's a problem. And the actual company started in 2010, but there was this little thing called the 2008 crash. They came right in the middle of that. I was fortunate enough to start my company on January the 5th, 2008. I left my partner and went out on my own on January 5th, 2008. Thank God for good customers that, you know, that carried me, that took care of me, that allowed me to, you know, be able to do that because I took care of them. But it's amazing how, and I remember watching this in one of your videos, is that there used to be the fact that when we had a down economy, fine, you let people go. And then as the economy increases, as it becomes better, you're not willing to risk having full-time employees yet. So you hire people part-time. You hire them on a gig basis. You hire them as you needed. And then you convert them to a full-time basis. But you said in your video that 2008 was a watershed moment because people did not convert those people. And the question is why? Why was at this point in time, was there not the conversion? And what was the catalyst that people sat there and said, wait a second here, we don't have to have another 40,000 people, 20,000 people, 5,500 people on payroll. We can do it a different way.
So this decoupling from the countercyclical trends, which you highlighted, right? Like when the economy is good, the gig economy would do poorly. But when the economy is bad or starting to recover, the gig economy do well. This was countercyclical to the economic cycle. It decoupled in beginning in 2008, but we really see it in the data around 2010, 2011, as the recovery really takes hold. Because as we know, the economic recovery from the Great Recession was a very slow economic recovery. So it took us until about 2011 to kind of really start seeing it in the data that the gig economy wasn't decreasing. It continued to grow. There were a host of reasons. One was a psychographic change that workers all of a sudden said, no, I'm okay being on demand. Whereas before, workers were very focused on, no, I want to get that full-time job. And some of that had to do with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Suddenly, I was able to decouple from work my healthcare. So I knew now I could go into these exchanges and I could get healthcare. It may not be the best plan. It may not be this, that, and the other thing. I'm certainly not here to debate that. But there was an understood option that suddenly tens of millions of people were taking. And so that allowed for some decoupling and the psychographic shift. If I were to ask somebody in 2007, what is the number one word that comes to mind when you say freelancer? The number one associated word at the time was unemployed. Oh, you're a freelancer. That's adorable. You're really unemployed. Go get a job. If you ask people today, Ben, what is the number one word associated with freelancer? You know what they say? Entrepreneur. They're entrepreneurs now. Amazing. Huge difference. Huge change. So we had the psychographic shift. We had it was driven by a host of things, including healthcare, but we also had system shifts. So work market was coming on stream, not that we were big enough in 2010 as we were just starting to impact this, but there was another category of software called VMS, vendor management systems, that help companies manage their temps. The largest of which are Fieldglass, IQ Navigator, Beeline, and a host of others. They were coming on stream. The point being, one of the reasons that you converted people from a temp or a freelancer or other gig workers into a full-time worker is because you didn't have the systems to manage them as temps and freelancers. And so you'd look around and be like, whoa, who are all these people? We need to get them into our payrolling systems. We need to get them into our ADP HR systems so we know who they are, what they're doing, so we can have better control and understanding and insight into our workforce. Because when they're gig, somebody's managing them off a spreadsheet. Now, with VMS software and WorkMarket creating the category of FMS software, freelance management system, you suddenly had the systems to manage them efficiently and compliantly. So you didn't feel the need. You weren't getting HR, legal, and procurement saying, whoa, convert all these people to full-time because we don't know who they are. So we had a psychographic change and we had a systems change that both led to that decoupling.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. You had a technology change in terms of laptops were faster. Sure. Smartphones were coming onto the market. Internet speeds were becoming a point where you could actually have live conversations across the internet, Skype at that point, the novelty of Skype, to be able to have video chat and all those type of things, where it enabled workers to be remote and actually log into systems and be able to log into networks in a way that they never could before because there just wasn't the technology. So I'm sure there was a myriad of different things that allowed that to happen.
100%. Very, very, look, very accurate. Technological change has enabled this kind of breaking of the bone. And when I called the book The End of Jobs, it's not to say that I think jobs are going. The conclusion of the book is actually quite the opposite, that robots and AI will have no net impact on the number of jobs in society, and net being the important word there. But when I talked about the end of jobs, I was talking about the end of the 9 to 5, one office, one manager job. That job is going. And technology, like all the things you just highlight, highlighted are one of many factors that help break that bone of no, we need everybody in this office from 9 to 5. They all have to be within one reporting structure, and we need to understand everybody is. That job is dying. Technology is accelerated. COVID has certainly accelerated, and the remote workforce and the gig workforce are all a very big component of the new world of work.
And when I think of all that, the one word that comes to mind is control. You know, is the ability to control, because there's a lot of workforces right now that are doing whatever they can to try to drive the workforce back to the office. You know, whether this is good for the business, whether it's good for the employees, whether it's good for the leadership, they're trying to bring people back to the office. First of all, they've got these enormous buildings that they're paying leases on, you know, that are sitting empty, and they're sitting there going, they just look at this as a cost center that's being wasted. But it's also a myriad of control. I mean, I hear stories about people in March of 2020 that were having keyboard trackers installed on all their software. So, the leadership, quote unquote leadership, could make sure that you actually were working from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I look at it as control and trust. So my question is, how do we go from a control and trust environment to one where it is expectation-based, one where we are sitting there going, I don't care whether you work 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day, 20 hours a day, I need you to do this task, and I'm going to pay you to get this task done. You know, and when that task is done, we're going to work on the next task. But how do we shift that mentality from a workforce point of view to be able to make people task-related workers and ideation workers instead of 9 to 5, you know, put in your hours and I'll pay you for that amount of time that you're there?
Oh my gosh, we could literally just spend an hour on just responding to that. You and I could go back and forth. This is a great, great question, and because it hits on so many different themes. And to answer the question, I would say we need to go back in the history of work, because this is a constant tension between companies and workers. And I argue in the book that we can think about the history of work and, quite frankly, the future of work as this undulating power balance between companies and workers, where companies almost always have the preponderance of power in that relationship, where in our 3 industrial revolutions that have occurred, and we're now on the 4th industrial revolution, as a lot of people call it, power accumulates even more to companies, and you get these counterbalancing forces that workers argue for that are regulations, the social safety net, and unions or collective association, because I think the union structure is evolving, that help not bring things into a balance of power. There's never going to be balance, but within some sort of stability. And so within that is the company's inherent need to control these workers to maximize productivity. And companies have always had that. Now, it's easier to do when everyone's on a factory floor and everything is quantifiable. But as you move to more knowledge work, what is productivity? You know, I would get some snipings from some people in my office, because sometimes I'd come in at noon. It's my company. I'll come and go as I want. And every now and again, someone would say some sort of snarky comment that I would overhear. And I'd be like, let me be really clear. I can pick up that phone and in 20 minutes, do what it takes you a week to do. And I'm not boasting. I'm just saying I'm very efficient because of the relationships I've built up, because of the reputation I've built up. So yeah, I can work when I want and how I want. And I've earned that right. Does that make me inefficient? Does that mean I'm not as productive? No, I'm super productive. But how do you measure it? So this becomes, and I think keyboard tracking and all sorts of other things are just insane, but they fundamentally go to the supply and demand balance of workers. If you want to treat workers like cogs in a machine, then you better make sure that they are very interchangeable and there's a large supply of workers ready to fill those roles, because you're going to have people that are unhappy and they're going to leave you as quickly as they can. If there is a huge supply and demand the other way, and think about blockchain developers or cybersecurity experts or AI experts, I mean, very STEM-oriented and technology-driven jobs, there are a massive shortage of those types of workers. And you know how almost all, and I shouldn't say almost all, that's statistically incorrect, a large number of those workers want to work, not as a full-time worker anywhere. They work as on-demand workers. They say, oh, yeah, I'll come and I'll consult for you for 6 months, and I'm going to come and go as I please. because that's what the worker wants. And the company doesn't have a choice. They're like, well, you're the only person that even responded to the ad. So yeah, I mean, you're the only person I could get on the phone. So however you can help us, please help us. Okay, that's how we see the extreme one way. And we talked about the extreme the other way with keyboard tracking and, you know, monitoring your workers ridiculously. And it differs industry by industry, job function by job function, sometimes company by company. But in this market that we have now, where there are acute labor shortages, and we can talk about why that is, and hopefully it'll be temporal and it'll pass. If you want to be an employer of choice, and I would say every employer wants to be an employer of choice, because people, it's not lip service. Your number one asset are your people, and you either attract the right people that are going to move the needle, or you are just getting a bunch of people that are punching the clock and want to get the heck out of there. If you want to be an employer of choice, then you want to have an effective team. The underlying variable, the most important aspect, is trust. And if you want to have the best and the brightest come, then you got to trust them. And that doesn't mean you don't have KPIs and you're not managing to them. Of course you do that. But that amount of control, I will say that over time, has not served companies well, save for specific industries and specific functions. Because you know what? If you need to get a certain number of widgets out the door and it's not happening and your processes aren't working, then change your people. And I'm sorry, but there are certain jobs and certain functions where you have no bargaining power. And that is what it is. Like that is just the laws of economics.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. I mean, I use the phrase all the time that it says your brand is only as valuable as your unhappiest employee on their worst day. You know, it's just, if you have unhappy employees, if your employees are miserable, if they don't feel listened to, understood, and valued, they're never going to represent your brand, whether they're gig employees, full-time employees, whether they work at head office or the branch office, it doesn't matter. Senior leadership down to the person on the floor, every single person represents your brand. And you need to make sure that those people feel like they're valued, that they're part of the team, that their work actually matters to be able to move the business forward. Because if they don't, they become more of a hindrance for your company than they become a help. And I think that leaders need to understand that their role is to enable new leaders to emerge and allow other people to have the ability to grow within the company.
So, Ben, I will agree vehemently with all of that. Mm-hmm. The only build that I'd love to do here is to say, but that's not necessarily true of every single company. I think that's the best way to succeed. I'm in violent agreement again. But if that's not what's optimal for you, just be very clear about it. Don't put on the wall, we value the employees. You don't value the employees if that's what you're doing. You just want cogs. And if that's what you want, I think it's terrible. I don't think it's optimal, but I won't pretend to understand every company and every industry and every job function. I don't. But be very clear. And I will say, tell you that what I have found as I've studied the history of work and advised companies on labor force transformation is that transparency and authenticity is very valued. Like, yeah, no, my company doesn't care about me. They just want me to come in and do a job and I'm fine with that. Great. You'll get the worker that wants that. Again, it doesn't work for me. I wouldn't run a team that way. But if that's who you are and that's what works for you, just be clear about it. And I think you'll have a much better chance of being successful.
I agree, because there are certain people out there that just want to come in, do their job, get a paycheck. And when they walk out the door, they're gone. You know, they don't want to be invested in the company. They don't want to go to company picnics. They don't want to be on the bowling league. They don't want to, you know, go for drinks with people. They want to come in, run the press, you know, ship the stuff, be the shipper, whatever they need to do, do their job, go home to their wife and their kids and be with their friends. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But you need to understand, both as a company and as an individual, what are people's motivations? And be able to, as you said, you need to be open and clear and honest about it. You know, if we're not looking for great big idea people, don't put "we need great big idea people" as the first line on your job application or your ad in the newspaper. It's hire the people to be part of the culture that you actually have, not the culture that you think everybody wants you to be.
I am very clear. It is very difficult to work at a company I run. We actually do have bowling teams and things like that because I love that stuff. And I think it's super fun. I think everyone should do it. And I don't understand people don't like bowling. What's not to love about bowling? But like, it is very clear with everybody from the job posting and from the interviews, what it is like to work at a company I am running. Because my nightmare scenario is you get there and after, you know, a month, you're like, wow, I don't like it here. I'm going to quit. And you're like, all right, well, we just wasted all this time recruiting you. Then we hired you and we onboarded you and now you're leaving. That's a terrible scenario. I'd rather be very upfront that it is, look, it is a hard charging environment. We are here to get things done. We are not here to talk about your feelings. Like, we are very results oriented and that's who we are. And we think we're going to do a lot of great things. And I think I'm going to make you a lot of money. And but if you're not on board with that, if that's not what you want, don't come. And that's fine. Fine for you, fine for our team. And I think we've been very lucky. And I will take the fact that most of my employees, now that they know I'm going to start another company, have been reaching out, asking to come back. I will take it as a sign that we're doing something right.
And, you know, people are drawn to people. You know, people sit there and say, okay, this is what I can expect from Jeff as a boss. This is exactly what I'm going to get from Jeff. I know where he stands. I know when I'm in trouble. I know when I've done a good job. I know if I do this, this is what the possible outcome is probably going to be. That's a great place for a lot of people to work, either whether it's from a gig point of view or a full-time employee point of view. But if people understand where they stand, what's expected of them, what the motivations are, what the triggers for success are, what the opportunities are, they're willing to stay. I mean, I've got stats that tell me that every employee that leaves you costs you $100,000 to replace. So why would you want to hire somebody that, you're right, a month, 2 months, 3 months later goes, I don't want to be here. You know, I don't want to be here. And that's probably a great thing about gig workers is that you can have them work for you for 6 months, you know, on that gig basis, say, hey, listen, you're here temporary to do this contract. If you really like it, let's have a conversation. And you can either, the person can either continue to be gig or you can morph them. But it's a matter of looking at the economy differently, saying, how do we make things work for everybody? How, as you said, it's that balance of power. And how, you know, what are the things that most companies are getting wrong right now? Because there's got to be one or two things that most people just are either they're not paying attention to or they're overlooking that are going to be those little tweaks that are going to make them go from good to great.
So I will tell you this, and we're going to actually circle back and touch on a few things we touched on, but I'm going to frame them in a little bit different way. When I am asked, and I've been asked over these last 18 months, oh my gosh, what do we do with remote work? How do we keep a cohesive culture? How do we keep people productive? Oh my gosh, what do we do with more gig workers? How do we keep a cohesive culture? How do we keep everyone productive? And I will start by saying, all right, well, let's double click on that word culture. What does that mean to you? Do your people understand who you are, why you're here, where you're going, what you stand for? Those are the big four. Because when people say, oh, culture this, culture that, I will always say, do you have a culture document? Are you codifying? Are you writing down on paper who you are, why you're here, where you're going, and what you stand for, right? So the mission, the purpose, the one description, your values. And importantly, do you then write down all the policies and procedures and behaviors that support all those things? Because if you don't do it, they're just words on the wall. Our friends at Enron had, you know, accountability and honesty up on their wall. You know what they were? They're bullshit, right? They're just words on a wall. They didn't mean anything. What are the behaviors? They would have been better off, by the way, if up on their wall it said, make money at every cost and cut every corner just to make a dollar. They might still be around, quite frankly.
But they wouldn't they wouldn't have been crucified in the press as badly. I'll tell you that much.
Like, hey, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. We are running and gunning. But the culture document to me is the most important thing because it is that take of authenticity. This is who we are. And it's a chance for your team, by the way, because these culture docs are living documents, right? They're constantly iterated. And so every culture doc we had at Work Market, every time I was with people on a team level, having, you know, a team lunch and stuff, I'd be like, is there anything anybody wants to call bullshit on? You know what? Hey, you say this, but we don't really do it. Because if we don't do it, then either we should do it or we should stop saying it. And I'm good with either one, quite frankly. But, you know, as the person running the company, I will make the decision as to which one I think is optimal. But if it's not for you, that's fine. And so you share the culture document when you're recruiting people. You use the culture document when you're promoting people and you're giving them raises. Because if they're not doing everything you say, the proverbial brilliant jerk, right? If the brilliant jerk is getting promoted, then everyone's going to be like, all right, so I guess collaboration isn't important. And you say it is, but clearly it isn't. You have to be authentic. And if you're doing all those things, which most companies are getting wrong because they're not codifying the document, it's not clear to everybody who they are, why they're here, where you're going, right? And I will tell you, even for someone that preaches this, when ADP was buying us, they interviewed all my employees, not, you know, to interview for their jobs. They just wanted to talk to everybody. And they did. I was like, talk to whoever you want. Do whatever you want. We're open book. And they came back to me and they said, hey, you know, we asked everybody, what is Work Market? Asked them to describe the company. And here are, Jeff, 72 different answers.
Wow.
We had about 200 employees at the time. I got to admit, it was like a kick in the gut. I was like, oh my gosh. I thought everybody knew the sentence I said, but just because I said it every now and again, I didn't have it on a document that they looked at every team meeting. And subsequently, by the way, every team meeting started out with who we are, why we're here, and where we're going. I want them to understand who we are, that one sentence. I want them to be able to sing it, right? I want them to understand the why we're here, why you get out of bed every morning and come to this company. And I want them to understand where we're going. I want them to understand what our North Star is, because I want them to go and make their own decisions and be doing things. I want to tell them the what that has to be done, and they can determine the how. They're on the front lines. They're talking to customers. They are having a billion conversations that I'll never be privy to. And so this is something that a lot of companies get wrong. The who we are, why we're here, where we're going, our values, and all the behaviors, policies, and procedures that support it. And if you're doing that well, you are building the glue between your organization. And it doesn't matter if you got a bunch of gig workers. It doesn't matter if the teams are remote and it's hybrid work and you're not seeing each other all the time. You will be able to maintain that culture and that productivity if you are very clear about what that culture is. So that is my answer to your question.
No, I agree with you. I mean, that's why we created Podcast Host for Hire. I mean, that's what we do, is we do internal podcasts for large to enterprise level companies. It's part of what we do, where they're internal, they're behind closed doors, they are on, you know, secure servers, and it enables large organizations to be able to hear from the horse's mouth what's going on in different departments, different divisions, different countries, et cetera, to be able to make sure that purpose and culture issues are dealt with, that, you know, new product development is dealt with, DEI issues are dealt with, to be able to have a better understanding of the story so every employee can tell the story. It is so important that employees understand the brand story, where you came from, where you are, where you're going, why, and why what I do matters. I think you're brilliant. I think that that's brilliant.
When I tell people this, I'll say, look, when you think you've said it too many times, you're about halfway there. Right, because I was 100% sure that every single one of Work Market's employees would have said, Work Market's enterprise software to enable companies to organize, manage, and pay their freelancers. I thought everyone would say that sentence. They didn't. Legitimately, by the way, nobody did. Like, not there's not just 72 different answers, by the way, 72 answers, none of which were my sentence. And so I was like, oh my God, what did I do here? I wasn't saying it enough. I wasn't doing it. But anyway.
But it doesn't have to be that exact sentence. It has to be the nuance of that sentence that tells people exactly what you do and how you do it. Everybody's going to tell that story slightly differently, but it's got to be the right story. And that's the important thing.
And just to highlight this, because people are like, oh, what difference does it make? There were people on my team that were saying, oh, we're a marketplace for labor. Here's a very important distinction. I appreciate it. I called the company Work Market, and that was mistake number one of the 10,000 mistakes I made while building this company. But we're not a marketplace. If you are a salesperson, you're going out there, you're talking to a customer saying, oh, we've got a marketplace full of people. They're going to think that we do and we don't. And so it's a nuance, right? Like, are you a marketplace or a platform? No, we're a platform. And that's why that word was so important in that sentence. Because I had people out there talking to customers, talking to prospects, saying we were a marketplace, and those people would come on and they would be disappointed.
Brand and confusion.
So, yeah.
Brand confusion.
Words, and that, to your point, the words, the exact words maybe don't have to be perfect, but it's the narrative of who we are that is super important. And if everybody's not aligned, then you don't have your team rowing in the same direction, and you're not going to get to that North Star.
So how's the best people to get in touch with you? Through jeffwald.com? Is that the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Well, I'm super psyched that you went there. It is actually a very new site, but yes.
I love it. I think it's clean. I think it's beautiful. I think you did a nice job with it.
I bought that URL in like 1997, I think, maybe 1996. And it took a solid, 20 plus years to get content up there. But there is now content up there, and that is the best place to always get in touch.
Awesome. So one last question, then I'm going to let you out the door. When you leave a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about Jeff when you're not in the room?
Wow. I would want people to leave that meeting thinking we accomplished our goal. That was an effective use of time sitting with Jeff. And that is why I start every meeting by saying, what is the goal? I mean, if it's an internal meeting, there has to be a goal and an agenda on the meeting invite. But if it's an external meeting, I start out and I will say, what's the goal of this conversation? You know, we've got 30 minutes together. I want to make sure we hit your goals. And people sometimes are taken aback. They're like, oh, well, we wanted to ask for your advice on this thing, but we didn't know. I'm like, great, let's do that. And so I hope as I get in the car and drive away, I hope I learned how to drive because, you know, I live in New York City and I don't really have a car, or really know how to drive. So I hope for everyone else's sake on the road that I know how to drive. But I hope people say, we hit our goal. That was an effective use of time. That's what I hope.
And this has been an enormous efficient use of time. So Jeff, thank you for being on the show. Thanks for being such an amazing guest. Thanks for Mark Hirschberg for putting us together. He did not disappoint, Mark. I promise you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was super fun.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?